Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Other Hand is part of the Acast Creator Network.
I want to start off today by a quick run through some data. Starting domestically with Irish house prices, we got the latest data for January. National prices increased by 0.7%, and the annual rate of increase has gone up to 5.4. Dublin up by 0.9 in the month, 4.5% on the year, and outside of Dublin up 0.6 and 6.1% on the year. Okay, so what those statistics are basically telling us, and it's something we have spoken about over the last 3 or 4 months, you know, the housing market here is accelerating again. There is no doubt about that. And it's a supply-demand equation. There's also a lot of cash buyers in the market that are pushing prices up. And I've had some practical experience of this very, very recently. National average house prices are now 8.2% above the peak seen back in April 2007, just before it crashed. Dublin prices are 3.1% lower than their February 2007 peak. And outside of Dublin, prices are 8.9% higher than the May 2007 peak. And just to, I don't want to bombard you with statistics, but I'm going to, Chris and the listeners, I apologize. But it is interesting to see that national prices have increased by 141.2% from their early 2013 trough. Dublin prices are up 140% from their February 2012 trough, and outside of Dublin up 150% from the May 2013 trough. So it's a market characterized by very, very strong demand pressures, limited supply despite the progress that's been made. Prices continue to rise. If this growth was being driven by excessive mortgage lending, I'd be here now roaring at you, Chris, that it's a bubble, it's going to burst, we're going to see a significant correction in the market over the next couple of years. But it's not been driven by credit. It's been driven by demographics. It's been driven by the fact that there's just this natural growth in demand and limited supply, particularly in some areas.
Jim, I know what I'm about to say will upset you greatly, but if you see me sawing my leg off with a blunt penknife when you're going through all these numbers, please don't take it personally. And I realize that I'm actually in a smaller minority than I thought when you go through your very important, dare I say, statistics, and that we've had a communication overnight where somebody's asking us to put into writing all of the stats that you recite because they're so important that he plays the podcast 2 or 3 times to listen to them. So that's in stark contrast to yours truly. But there we go.
You don't enjoy my stats, Chris. You don't enjoy my stats.
I love them, Jim. I absolutely adore them. And what those remarks are really to apologize because you may have said it already during your preamble, and I may have lost the will to live during that time. But Did you say that Dublin and or the country outside Dublin or the country as a whole, I know they've gone up 100-odd% since the trough, but are they higher than their previous peak pre-financial crisis or pre-pandemic?
Chris, you weren't listening. Nationally, prices are 8.2% above the April 2007 peak.
Because that was financial crisis Dublin, time, wasn't it?
8.9% higher than the May 2007 peak. Dublin is slightly different, still 3.1% below the February 2007 peak.
So every house owner in Ireland is in the money then, on average. Obviously, there are people depending on when you bought it. But if you were a long term holder of property in Ireland, you are back in the money. Is the message of the numbers?
Yes, it is indeed, Chris. I remember, I talk to you about this sometimes, and it kind of upsets me sometimes, and sometimes it goes straight over my head. I get dreadful abuse, you know, over stuff I say. People come back and remind me of stuff I said 10 or 15 years ago or longer, telling me I'm a dickhead, I know nothing, etc. But I remember in the early 2000s talking about, I wrote a piece in the Farmers Journal on land prices, and I was sort of advocating as a long-term investment, I'd definitely gone into land prices. And then 2 or 3 years later, land prices took a little bit of a dip. And I had people on saying, shows you all, you know, that here land prices fallen, and you were advocating them as a long-term bet. And the point is that they have turned out to be long-term bet. Land prices are multiples higher today than they were back in the day, back when I was saying those things. So if I had bought land then and held on to it, I'd be well in the money at this stage. And likewise with housing on average. Of course, I still come across people who bought at really, really excessive levels back in 2007, 2008, particularly apartments, and they are now still in negative equity. But on average, it just shows you that your time horizon is just so important.
Yeah, I think property is very much like equities, actually. They're different asset classes, but the context of time is the most important thing, which is that if you wait long enough, historically at least, you will be paid to own these assets. The problem is that people don't realize just how long enough can be. Sometimes you can be paid very quickly. Sometimes it takes years. But eventually, history teaches us that you get paid from holding these assets. And I've always had the belief with property that if you can ride out one full cycle, including the downdraft, and get through to the other side without being wiped out, as a rule of thumb, you'll generally be okay. And so it's proved with this particular property cycle. It's been a long one. It's been a long time since the financial crisis now, a lifetime for many people. But in one sense, I think it's a good thing. I know there are lots of bad aspects about this, and I know I bang this drum, but you talked about the factors that have driven house prices up again in Ireland, demographics, the supply-demand balance, the issues that we have with construction. But I would say that one key thing that describes all of those factors to a certain extent is that high house prices, the housing crisis, if you like, is a problem of economic success. And that's the common factor across all jurisdictions that have housing crisis. And I've said this before, so I don't want to bore people to death, but if you pick up newspapers in Portugal, in Canada, in the United States, in all sorts of different jurisdictions where economies, to greater or lesser extents, are doing well, then you have the words housing crisis on a daily basis in the media. It is not unique to Ireland. What is unique to Ireland, I think, is the degree of economic success that you have had. And I think eventually things will catch up. You will build enough houses and you will sort this out. But again, it's that point about time. I'll shut up now, Jim. Take us through some more numbers, because I think there's been some very, very important ones out today, haven't there?
Yeah, we had the purchasing managers indices of manufacturing and services, and then there's a composite index. And for listeners, just to explain once again that the way these indices are constructed, a reading above 50 means that more businesses are expanding than contracting. A reading below 50 means that more businesses are contracting than expanding. Okay, the UK composite index was at 52.9, down from 53 marginally. Services fell from 53.8 to 53.4, and manufacturing increased from 48.3 to 50.2. So a mixed bag there, but generally it describes a UK economy that in the first quarter will emerge from the technical recession that we saw delivered in the second half of last year. In the euro area, the composite index jumped from 49.2 to 49.9. Okay, and this is, okay, it's still contractionary, but it improved during the month and we're now on the brink of going back into growth territory. So that's good news. In the United States, and there is a theme here, Chris, that I think we'll get back to in a second. In the States, the services PMI fell from 52.3 to 51.7, which is a three-month low. So modest contraction there, but the overall, it's still expanding, if you get my point. A modest weakening, but it's still overall expanding. Manufacturing jumped from 52.2 to 52.5, which is a 21-month high. And the composite purchasing managers index jumped, fell slightly from 52.5 to 52.2. What all of these indicators tell me in a nutshell, Chris, is that in the first quarter of the year, we are seeing some modest uptick in global economic activity. And I think that is consistent with a lot of other data releases we're seeing around the place.
Yeah, I think that's right. I don't think it's stratospheric. I don't think we're off to the moon with respect to economic growth. But the first quarter, which we are now approaching the end of, looks to have been okay for the world economy. I'm not sure how many people thought it was going to be as good as it has been. And one of the things that one of the many things that I think is propelling stock markets to incredible highs, actually, around the place, is the fact that growth and therefore ultimately profits will be fine in 2024. Whether or not that's a previous judgment, a premature judgment, it remains to be seen. But I think that there's a building growth story, which is really interesting to contrast against what's been happening this week with respect to what all of the world central banks have been doing. We've had an actual hike in Japan, which we talked about in the last podcast. We've had a surprise cut in interest rates from Switzerland, which is being taken as a bit of a steer as to where Europe might be going, cutting sooner rather than later, maybe. I'm not so sure about that. We've had the Bank of England governor today hinting slightly that he may be inclined to cut interest rates in May rather than the June bet that the markets currently have. So I think that's taken markets by surprise. And the FTSE is up.
Yeah. Sorry for disturbing you, but I will, because you always disturb me. We had one member of the Monetary Policy Committee actually voting for a rate cut today, so that definitely...
And the two hawks who bizarrely have been arguing for rate hikes dropped their desire for rate hikes. They were two rather odd members of the Monetary Policy Committee, if you ask me. But when you put all of that together, which is that, and with what the Federal Reserve said this week, which I think was consistent with Jerome Powell, the chairman of the Fed, saying he's reasonably relaxed about things, and leading commentators such as Mohamed El Arian have been saying that he thinks what's going on is the Fed in particular, but central banks in general, sending a signal that they are happy, relatively speaking, with inflation at around 3%, and they're not going to, you know, bust their asses to try and get it down to 2%, which is an interesting perspective, and it's one that I've held for a long time. I think it's what they should do. I think they should accept 3% and not worry too much about getting it all the way down to 2%, because I think things may develop in that way anyway. But when you put those stories about interest rates coming down and central banks being relaxed with the stock market that's off to the moon, partly on the basis of those relaxed interest rate comments, but also on the back of those economic growth stories that we are painting. We've been talking for some time about growth being better than expected. You and I have anyway. And I wonder whether we are heading for an issue, which is that if growth continues to accelerate, and service sector inflation in particular continues to be a problem, because if you delve underneath all the inflation numbers, service sector prices in the United States in particular are still a bit of an issue. I wonder whether the three interest rate cuts that the markets are betting on in the States will actually come through. You've heard me say that for quite some time, and I've speculated no more than that, that we may not get any interest rate cuts at all.
And I'm saying we will, Chris, okay?
Well, we, as always, Jim, we have a very friendly disagreement. It's a good job that we don't record these interviews in the same room, because therefore we will never actually come to blows, only verbal ones. So there we are, Jim. I mean, what do you, the thing that really strikes me as we record this are the strength of equity markets. What signals do you think they're sending?
Well, can I say, first of all, getting back to my personal investment decision 2 weeks ago.
It must have gone up.
€198, well, 200 plus fees taken out, 198. It went down to under 185 yesterday. It's back up at 194 at the moment. So I'm still in negative territory. But I guess the point of this experiment for me was just to expose myself to some of the volatility in this crazy market. And by God, is it volatile. But you look at what's happening on the equity side. I just went on the screen there before we did the podcast. This is being recorded Thursday afternoon. All markets are in strong positive territory today, even the FTSE 100, which has done nothing for hundreds of years. Basically, markets are still on fire. And the reason why today is because of interest rates. So they still,
Jim,
matter, Chris.
You do realize the company you're keeping when you buy Bitcoin?
I do.
There are lots of very legal, honest, decent people to buy Bitcoin. I'm not painting them all with the same brush I'm about to paint you. But there's a great story in the FT today about a woman who's been found guilty of something or other, fraud, money laundering, I'm not quite sure which. But the basic idea was that the cops a while ago raided a mansion in Hampstead, which is a very leafy suburb of North London, because they suspected something really dodgy was going on. And they found a woman there. They found two women there, actually. And it, long story short, the senior partner of these two women, shall we say, in this particular financial scam thing, fraud, whatever was going on, she's disappeared. And the cops found not only passwords, but the actual Bitcoin wallets that they've been operating a scam in China and laundering the proceeds through Bitcoin. And they found over $1 billion of Bitcoin in these wallets. And it was all fraudulent money, they think. And this is the company you're keeping, mate. You know, people who launder money, people who buy their drugs, buy their guns, and do all sorts of illicit things using Bitcoin wallets. So, mate, you're in good company.
Chris, I've sat in the stands at Loftus Road watching QPR play. I occasionally attend boxing fights, and you know, the company you keep at some of these events wouldn't necessarily be the company you'd like to go out with on a Friday night. But likewise, you know, I can't take responsibility for the company I keep in terms of Bitcoin investing. But Chris, you have to remember that my investment in Bitcoin was for purposes of research to enhance the quality of discussion in this podcast, okay?
That's what all drug dealers say.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Chris, can I move on, actually?
Please do.
Leo Varadkar stepped down on Wednesday. Came as a huge shock to many people. But I guess, you know, after the two referenda that were lost a few weekends ago, the writing was definitely on the wall. And of course, He got his trip into the White House, which was very important, and then resigned as soon as he came back. I remember back in the early 2000s, okay, I wasn't a fan of Enda Kenny. Okay, I should say, Chris, as you know, I do tend to have a tendency towards being a Fine Gael voter, okay?
Your shirt today is very blue, Jim.
But back in the day when Enda Kenny was a couple of years into his leadership, I wasn't a fan. And I remember being on an RT radio show one morning where I was saying that Fine Gael are going nowhere under Enda. I was wrong. He turned out to be a pretty decent leader. But anyway, that was my view at the time. I do get things wrong occasionally. And I said that they should just get rid of him at this stage and bring in Leo Varadkar. I was always a fan, very impressed by him since he began life in politics. My view on him has varied, you know, quite a lot. It's nearly as volatile as cryptocurrency over the last couple of years, because there's a bit of me that was always concerned by, and I know he denies this himself, but the woke agenda that he's been sort of pursuing. My view was that a lot of this stuff, including the two referenda, was never going to appeal to the traditional Fine Gael voter, and was really trying to appeal to people who were never going to vote Fine Gael anyway. That was my sort of perception of some of what Leo Varadkar was doing. But generally, if you think about the, since he took over, you know, the challenges he faced, we had COVID-19. We've had the whole cost of living crisis. We've had the Ukraine war. So the most important one of all was Brexit. Okay, so he's been in power for some incredibly volatile, difficult, challenging events at a domestic and global level. And yet, I think it is definitely the case that Leo Varadkar played a very, very strong hand in the Brexit negotiations. And I think, on balance, Ireland did well out of those negotiations. And I would certainly put that down to the strength of political leadership here. We were lucky, of course, that we had strong support from the European Union, but domestic leadership was really important. In terms of COVID, and we've discussed this in the past, you know, I wasn't enamoured with a lot of the measures that were put in place by the CMO at the time. But I do think, you know, Leo Varadkar recognised the necessity to provide strong support to businesses and households during the crisis. And the Irish economy did come out of COVID pretty strongly. And in terms of looking at the other, you know, economic metrics, and this does tie into something you wrote about in our Substack account overnight, which I want to talk to you about in a second. But you look at where the Irish economy is today. You know, record levels of employment, 4.2% unemployment rate, pretty strong public finances. We have challenges with health. We have challenges with housing that I mentioned. And indeed, there was a survey of members of the American Chamber of Commerce this week where 98% cited the availability of residential housing as a significant challenge, and 73% said housing was extremely or very challenging. So there are still challenges. And in the Dáil on Wednesday, Holly Cairns, who is the leader of the Social Democrats, was having a go at Leo, I thought pretty ungraciously, to be honest, given the day that was in it. But she was talking about the legacy of problems, housing, health, many other issues. And Leo responded by sort of saying that you're never going to wake up and find there are no problems, either as an individual or as a business or as a country. And that the notion that you could wake up and all the problems have gone away is a fairy tale. But she wasn't prepared to accept that. She said that's a fairy tale she'd like. But that brings me into, well, a couple of things, actually. One, I'd like to get your perspective on Leo Varadkar as Taoiseach as he steps down. And I think mine would be broadly positive, okay, but obviously shortcomings. Nobody is perfect. And the second thing is, I want to draw you into the piece you wrote on the Substack account. And I think this was probably, but not exclusively, driven by the piece by Janan Ganesh, excuse me, my pronunciation is probably all wrong. The piece he wrote about insoluble problems in the Financial Times earlier in the week. So when I heard Leo speaking yesterday about the fairy tale, etc., it did bring to mind this insoluble problem thing that Janan Ganesh wrote about.
Yeah, I do think, in answer to your first question, my thoughts on Leo Varadkar, a lot of the responses, not all, but quite a few of them around the place, I think are very begrudging, churlish, and as you say, ungracious. There's an article about him in the London Times today that I thought was well off and extremely unfair, because any one of the challenges that you listed there, I think, would have defeated a lesser Taoiseach, a lesser man, a lesser person. And I think he's risen to them in various ways with varying degrees of success. I think he's risen to them extremely well. And I think historians in the future are going to be very kind to Leo Varadkar. When we do the economy leader thing in the United States in particular, but also in the UK, for example, when people talk about the Trump presidency versus the Biden presidency, they count things like the number of jobs, incomes per head, real wages, things like that as markers of success or otherwise of their presidencies. And I think if you did the number of jobs, GDP per head, or perhaps GNI star per head, Jim, before you correct me, and the whole host of economic metrics that we measure US presidents by, Leo Varadkar would come out very, very well. The problems that, of course, he's getting blamed for, housing and health, the administration must carry some responsibility for not dealing with those as well as they should. But I do wonder, and this is in keeping with the end piece of your remarks there, whether they amount to the insoluble problems that Ganesh was referencing this week. His article was mostly about things in particular like regional development and the levelling up agenda in the UK, which has completely failed. And he talked about the ways in which there have been regional development grants, regional development authorities, there's been this spending initiative, all sorts of different ways in which over many, many decades, people have tried to do something about the poorer parts of the UK and indeed in many other countries, and how, as a general rule of thumb, they've all failed. Not every single one of them, but by and large, these efforts fail. And he thinks regional development is one of these insoluble problems. I can speak to that. I worked pro bono, I hasten to add, for the Welsh Assembly for 10 years a little while ago. And it was all about trying to get the Welsh economy going, and in particular, what to do about one of the most deprived regions of the UK, the South Wales Valleys. And I can tell you the number of policy initiatives that have come and gone, none of which have worked, speak very much to what Ganesh was saying about regional development. He talked about immigration as another one of those insoluble problems. And I think that there's a lot to be said for that. I think that the world has an immigration problem, not just Britain, not just Ireland. And, you know, you've got people on the move, you've got whole populations on the move and dealing with it in a way that would come to be regarded as successful, I think is impossible. And the other two things that I think very obviously are either extremely difficult or so far at least impossible to solve when you look at their prevalence around the world. And so what I'm saying is if a problem has been prevalent for a long time, loads of people have tried loads of different things to do something about them and failed, there's a prima facie case for saying that they're either extremely difficult to solve or, more pessimistically, they're impossible to solve, which is what Ganesh thinks that the things like immigration and regional development are. If you add housing and health and look at the initiatives that have been tried in the UK, in the United States, in Canada, in all sorts of different countries about these two issues, the problem is not the same in every country and it's not as big in every country, but they've all got problems with it. And so that too, I think, comes close. Those two things, housing and health, come close to being categorized as insoluble problems. At the very least, they're insoluble in the short term. And by the short term, I mean number of years. And they can only be cured by doing very difficult things over prolonged periods of time, if they can be cured at all. And sometimes I wonder whether the only cure, for example, for housing, for curing the housing crisis in the economies that I look at, would be a good old-fashioned recession. I don't know what else is going to work now. Because the more you build, the more you seem to have people wanting to come and live in your country. And those two problems often go together. So yeah, I think that to say that Varadkar's term of office is fundamentally tarnished by the housing and health problems, I totally understand why people say that, but I think it's actually very, very unfair.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree, I have to say. He was, of course, lucky or fortuitous in that for much of his term in office, we were seeing an escalation in corporation tax receipts. And it was those corporation tax receipts that actually facilitated a lot of the measures that were taken, particularly in response to COVID, but also in response to the cost of living crisis that resulted from the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So, you know, it's important to have lucky generals as well as good ones. But I think generally he showed a pretty decent level of leadership of the country. And, you know, I think he has done the state some service. Nobody's perfect. People get things wrong. We all do. And if there's any of our listeners out there who never got anything wrong in their life, I'd love to hear from him, actually, because see if I could learn anything. The Ganesh piece was fascinating. I thought he was saying there, you know, one of his conclusions was that there are such things as insoluble problems and rational despair. And that the best we can do is sort of mitigate those problems at the edges. That is, I guess, a pretty defeatist attitude. And I think we should just always, as policymakers, we should strive to make things as good as we possibly can. You can never give up, because the moment you give up, things are only going to deteriorate. Simon Harris is now very likely to take over as Taoiseach and leader of Fine Gael. Any views on him?
I don't know very much about him, Jim. I'm led to believe that he's a shoo-in for the leadership. And probably by the time this... I don't know what time scale it's going to take to elect the new leader. When will we know?
Okay, we will know by next Monday who has declared to run for leadership. The chances are it will just be Simon Harris, because Simon Coveney, Pascal Donoghue, Heather Humphreys, I think Helen McEntee, basically the front runners have ruled themselves out at this stage. So it would appear to be a coronation, which I actually think is a pity, because I think for Fine Gael, a leadership contest would be good, because it would give some exposure and so on. But anyway, it's not likely to happen. Simon Harris is incredibly ambitious, always has been. There is no doubt about that. He's 37, and if he becomes Taoiseach, he will be the youngest ever Taoiseach. And the previous holder of that accolade was Leo Varadkar, who became Taoiseach at 38. Okay, so he's young. He actually goes down very well with young people. I've seen him speak at events addressing young people, and definitely he does have appeal there, which I think is important. He's a very good communicator. There is no doubt about that. And he comes across as being passionate, empathetic, and so on. But I guess the big challenge for him will be he has a few weeks now ahead of European and local elections, and a few months ahead of a general election. You know, how much momentum he's going to be able to throw into a party that is actually struggling big time at the moment, not least because at this point in time, 11 TDs who were elected in February 2020 will not be going for re-election. Okay, Owen Murphy left early in the tenure of this government, but the other 10 have dropped out in recent weeks. So, and God knows how many more might drop out over the coming weeks, because politics is a dirty business and you need some stomach to be involved in it. But it's going to be a big challenge. And how he addresses these big issues, like addressing health, housing, and of course, immigration, I think will have a huge bearing on how he actually performs in those three elections.
I think we should expect the unexpected when it comes to Irish politics over the next few months. I know the opposition are calling for an immediate general election. Doesn't look like that's going to happen. But the slipping of Sinn Féin in the polls we've talked about before, and it's really interesting. The missteps by Mary Lou MacDonald, calling for resignations and all that sort of thing in the wake of the Dublin riots. The fact that she's in trouble with the anti-immigration crowd. She apparently is being barracked at some meetings by anti-immigrant people as being anti-Irish, which is quite an extraordinary thing, really, when you think about it. There's a long article about her and Sinn Féin in the FT this week, saying that they're in a certain amount of trouble because of their support for the referendum, because of this anti-immigration right-wing thing. And the fact that the young people that typically support Sinn Féin, and they do have a big cohort of support amongst younger people, younger people are very liberal when it comes to immigration. It's an old person's thing, this anti-immigrant stuff, typically. So striking that balance, I think, is proving to be very hard for the Shinners, and I think it's going to stay very hard. So I think that's going to be one to watch. But I do think that it throws open the result of the general election, and I wouldn't trust the opinion polls at all at the moment in Ireland. I think sentiment, voting intentions are going to be extremely volatile over the next while. So I think that to an unusual extent, it's all to play for.
It's absolutely impossible to call. I heard a few Sinn Féin people come out today criticising Fine Gael over the fact that they probably won't have a leadership contest. But my understanding is, as far as I remember, Mary Lou MacDonald and Michelle O'Neill both became leaders of the party in the respective countries without an election.
I'm not sure there has ever been an election for a leader of Sinn Féin in history, Jim.
No, there hasn't,
in fact,
actually.
I know there never has.
Yeah, exactly. So, Listen, I was trying to be charitable, okay? Chris, before we wrap, I want to ask you one thing. Vaughan Getting.
Yes. His nickname in the parts of Wales that I know is Born Guessing. And that's probably all you need to know in terms of what I think about him. There was a report out today from the Institute for Fiscal Studies about the Welsh education system. And the Welsh government has a number of what they call over here devolved competencies. Education and health are the two biggies for the Welsh government. And one of those two things was the subject of this report. And this report was absolutely brutal. The Welsh government has completely screwed with Welsh education, which is a great shame. The country I grew up in was very fond of its education system. It valued education, it valued teachers, it valued schools, and did a lot of things well. It did educate its young people. Sadly, a lot of them, the best and the brightest, dare I say, emigrated, often just to England, of course. And this report said that every bit of progress that the Welsh education system had made to about 2012 has gone backwards. And that all of the reforms that the Welsh government is doing should be paused, if not actually stopped. It was scathing. And it's on the back of something called PISA results, which are an international benchmark for educational standards. And I would also make similar remarks about the Welsh health system. If you thought the NHS in England was bad, you should have a look at it in Wales. It is dreadful. So I think the Welsh government's performance is absolutely appalling. I think Vaughan Gething, or Born Guessing, as I call him, has been a big part of that. And I'll just leave it there, Jim. I, as an ex-Welshman, I say ex, I suppose I still am in a way, I feel very strongly about the way in which Wales has been taken backwards by devolution, and that the outgoing First Minister, Mark Drakeford, I won't tell you my nickname for him, has presided over Wales going backwards. If you go to Wales these days, talk to people, look at the economic statistics, get a feel for the place, the vibe, you get the sense that it is a country that is accepting, in a very sullen way, mediocrity.
He's an interesting guy. I mean, his CV, in the sense that he is the first black leader of a European country. His father was white and worked in Africa, I think in some agri area, as far as I know, but he ended up marrying a Zambian farmer, who's Vaughn's
chicken
mother.
Chicken farmer.
So it's...
he's got a very interesting background.
He has. Sorry, is there some ascendancy here in terms of farming?
Well, you lot get everywhere.
What's wrong
you?
With a chicken farmer?
I didn't say there was. I just said she was. I just was stating a simple statement of fact. She was a chicken farmer.
Chris, good luck.
Speak to you soon, Jim.
I'm on a way to celebrate my birthday. Okay, talk to you.
Many happy returns.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.